Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Tim Johnson. He's an award-winning journalist, former bureau chief for Knight Ridder Newspapers and the McClatchy Newspaper Group in Beijing, China, and he's the author of the new book, Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. He'll be speaking on Friday, the 25th of February at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
As most people probably know, the Dalai Lama fled Tibet in 1959. Give us a sense of what Tibet looked like at that time and how the Chinese were taking and maintaining control of Tibet in the time that followed.
Well, you know, it was a very difficult experience for the Dalai Lama, who was young. He was a 24-year-old man at the time and had not had a lot of experience in leading the Tibetans, especially through a crisis like this. And so Chinese Red Army troops had amassed on the Lhasa Plain. They'd marched in from the eastern side of Tibet, from the Sichuan province, and there they were. An army commander had invited the Dalai Lama to a theatrical show, and his top advisors were going, well, you can't go. They could kidnap you. They could do something like that. And so the decision was made that he would go into exile in India. And over a course of a one-and-a-half-year period, about 120,000 Tibetans went with him. And the expectation was that certainly Mao Zedong intended to attain a very strong control of Tibet, but it wasn't by any means clear at that point that this would last 5, 10 years, 3 decades, 5 decades, or you know, as long as we've gone now, you know, more than 5 decades. So the Dalai Lama was originally thought that perhaps he would live in New Delhi, but the government of Prime Minister Nehru at the time said, no, go to the north. He didn't want the Dalai Lama there in New Delhi, where he could have a lot of contact with foreign dignitaries coming to visit India. It seemed like it would be safer to have him up in the hill country in the north. And so after a year or so, the Dalai Lama and his entourage, much of his entourage, ended up in the hill station of Dharamsala, which was a very sleepy place at that time. This is a little community that is beside the Punjabi plain, very hot plain, and this is a little higher, so it's cooler. You know, a lot of people from the British Raj during that era would go to Dharamsala to cool off during the summer. And there's actually even a British military commander who suggested that Dharamsala be made the summer capital of India. But then the Raj ended, and Dharamsala went back into obscurity, and there was a Dalai Lama in a place that was just a real backwater. And there he remained, and actually getting a lot of religious training for the first 10 years or so, and not knowing how long was this going to last. Well, as more time passed, it became apparent that this exile would last a long time. So the Dalai Lama, with the help of foreign followers, began to build schools and other institutions to take care of these Tibetan exiles who came with him, some of them just with, you know, basically the clothes on their backs. Well, now, 5 decades later, the Dalai Lama is there. They have a government in exile. Now, it's a very small government. They don't have the capability to, they can't arrest speeders, say, through the village or impose taxes in a way that's obligatory. So it's really more like a welfare agency. You know, I when I went there, I got the feeling of it being one of these small island capitals, you know, in the South Pacific. Or I once went to Belmopan, the capital of Belize, which is the smallest country in Central America. It had the same feeling. It's very sort of quaint, probably 7 or 8 buildings in all. And yet at the same time, it's a functioning government for the Tibetan exiles, and they provide all kinds of welfare services. They attend to the needs of those Tibetans who make the treacherous journey across the Himalayas to come and see the Dalai Lama in exile, or to actually live in exile and get educated in the system of the Tibetan children's villages, which are the schools that are provided to the exiles.
What were the Chinese reasons? I mean, what was their interest in Tibet? What were their reasons then, at the time that the Dalai Lama left, and now, not only for control, but for the real civil and cultural repression of Tibet?
Well, this is a very convoluted history, and depending on who you ask, whether you ask a Tibetan or a Han Chinese, Han being the majority in China, 92% of the 1.3 billion people in China are of what they call Han ethnicity, you get a very different answer to that question. The Chinese have had influence in Tibet, they claim, for more than 700 years. And, you know, in the period of the late 19th century and during lots of the 19th century and actually before, the dynasties would have a representative in Lhasa, what they called an amban. And this person was like a, you know, depending on how you your frame of reference, it could be like an American proconsul in a banana republic, or it could be just a very powerful ambassador or governor. And so the Dalai Lamas would rule in conjunction with this Chinese envoy there, and the envoy would often have a deployment of Chinese troops as well. Now, this came crashing down with the fall of Imperial China in 1911 and 1912. And so there was this period between that date, 1911, 1912, and 1949, in which the Tibetans basically ran their own affairs. They issued very, very simple, primitive passport documents. Now, I'm really talking basically parchment with some scribbling on it would serve as a passport. They issued stamps, but they didn't really take the final steps to declare nationhood in any sense that we would consider it formal. In other words, they issued stamps, but they didn't join the International Postal Union, which would mean you couldn't send a letter outside Tibet. They only tried to formalize diplomatic relations at the very end when it became apparent that Mao Zedong the modern Chinese state would attempt to incorporate Tibet into the bosom of the motherland, as it were. Now, so your question was, why did the Chinese do this? Well, Mao Zedong came with what he saw as a mandate to end what he considered the century of humiliation of China, where, you know, according to the modern the Chinese interpretation of history, China was picked apart by predatory foreign instincts, the foreign countries that came in and had these duty-free ports in which they would use their own judicial system, the Germans in Qingdao, you know, the various countries with their various ports. Portugal had Macau and so forth, British with Hong Kong. So this was a real sense of nation-building, as it were, for Mao Zedong and the Chinese. Now, let me jump forward to today. So this has been, you know, it's under strong Chinese control for more than five decades. But if you look at it today, Tibet is extremely important for China. It's 1/8 of the landmass of China. 7 of Asia's mightiest rivers come from the Tibetan Plateau, have their headwaters in the Tibetan Plateau. It's a natural buffer state to India, which has long been a rival of China. And in fact, you know, you could compare Tibet in some ways because of its altitude of some 13,000, 14,000 feet, and much, you know, great part of it is being like the Golan Heights looking over Israel. It's strategically very important. And China does have missiles pointed at India, despite a very thriving trade relationship. So for the Chinese, this is a non-negotiable issue. Tibet is part of China, and it's a critical part, and it would go to war to defend Tibet in an instant.
We're talking to Tim Johnson. His book is called Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. You have traveled to Tibet. You've seen it firsthand, both in Lhasa and outside of Lhasa. Starting with Lhasa, what does Lhasa look like at this point in history?
Well, you know, first off, it's just a beautiful city, especially as you approach it from a distance. I arrived there on this SkyTrain, which is this extraordinary engineering feat of modern China that they built. The first time that Beijing was connected to Lhasa by rail, and it was inaugurated in 2006. and I went to Lhasa in 2007 aboard that SkyTrain. This SkyTrain goes up to 16,400 feet, I believe, in altitude, give or take 100 feet. So, you know, at that altitude, you know, pens leak ink. If you have bags of chips, they blow up and sometimes explode, and you know, a terrible headache from the altitude. So you come down into the Lhasa Valley, and it's just really extraordinary because of the backdrop of the Himalayas and the Potala Palace, the seat of the Dalai Lama, traditionally is on a hill, and so it's often bathed in sunlight still while the rest of the city is in shade. And it's just really an extraordinary sight because of partly the altitude makes the air just crystalline. And you know, the rest of China, is a lot of it is very polluted. So this is one of the few places that you go in what is within the boundaries of modern-day China, and it's just it's pristine in many ways. But then you enter the city, and you realize, especially if you're if you talk to Tibetans or you know, have some contact with locals, that they're very unhappy with the changes in the city itself. The Chinese government does not say, except in most general terms, what the demographics of Tibet are today. But foreign experts and the U.S. government widely believe the figure that two-thirds of the Lhasa population is now non-Tibetan. So it's really changed the complexion of the city. And it's not only the faces that you see on the street. It's also that the Chinese administration has really opened up Tibet for anybody to go. Most Chinese are not able to very easily, say, move to Shanghai or Beijing or Guangzhou, but they can go to Tibet very easily, and they can find work there. Now, with this massive influx of Han Chinese to Tibet, it's gotten a seamy side to this city, so that the recent U.S. State Department human rights reports say there are hundreds of brothels now in Lhasa and in Shigatse, which is the number two city on the Tibetan plateau, and that between, you know, among all these brothels, there are now 10,000 sex workers in Tibet, and these are almost all, of course, migrants, so they'd be Han Chinese. So, you know, the Tibetans are really chagrined and peeved and deeply unsettled by this loss of a sense of what was once a holy city is now been, to their minds, been desecrated a bit.
What is happening to Tibetan language, culture, history, schooling, and so on for the ethnic Tibetan people who are living in Tibet?
Well, that's an interesting question, because one thing is what the Chinese government says and the laws that have been enshrined to protect minority rights, and the other thing is what is actually happening on the ground. And through a series of negotiations, you know, one could say that Mao Zedong was very aware that it was important to respect minority rights. He would often talk about what he called Han chauvinism. In other words, the majority Han were not treating the minority population of China in a fair way. And there's a very sizable minority population, by the way. So, you know, the Chinese government itself counts 55 ethnic groups outside of the ethnic Han. And Tibetans are by no means the largest of those groups. There's groups that you you probably haven't heard of, the Zhuang or the Muslim Hui. There's also the remnants of the Manchus, the Manchurian Empire. And so the Tibetans are, you know, they only number five and a half million people, more or less. Okay, so what's happened with education and with religious freedom to them? Well, with the evolution, with the passage of time, guarantees for Tibetan language education have really faltered, so that in most villages, children can get a Tibetan language education only in elementary school. And the teachers, the Tibetan teachers with whom I've spoken, say it's a pretty lousy education. It's just been stifled by a Communist Party controlling what the textbooks say, so that they become just very tedious. And then if you want to go beyond elementary school, you're going to have to study in Mandarin. And it's not just that you have to. It's just that the whole milieu that, in which you live is oriented towards you have to speak Mandarin to really get a significant job. And so, yes, the language is definitely under threat. Now, the religious factor is another element that enrages the Tibetans, and that is, first of all, the Dalai Lama is vilified as a criminal separatist. His photograph is banned, has been so for, a decade or so. And any discussion of this high lamas who now reside outside of Tibet in China is basically banned. Is a violation of state security laws. So, it's as if one were a Catholic and any discussion of the College of Cardinals or the Pope would be verboten. This is, untenable to Tibetans. So they see this as just a tremendously difficult situation for themselves. Let me just add one thing about that. It's just the whole nature of preserving culture. The Dalai Lama has stated repeatedly, I've heard him say that he feels that the Tibetan culture, and he's talking about just a whole sense of identity, is under what he considers a death sentence from the Chinese. Now, let me go into that a little bit because, I said there's only 5.5 million Tibetans, but they're spread over a very large geographic area. So that your Tibetans that live on the outlying eastern fringes of the Tibetan Plateau and those living on the north or the west would have fairly significant dialectical differences in language. And so when they meet, people would generally try to learn and speak the Lhasa dialect of Tibetan. So already, even though it's not a very large population, it's a fairly diverse group of people. And they also are not historically all followers of the Dalai Lama, because the Dalai Lama is the leader of one of the four major schools of Tibetan Buddhism. So up until this tragic situation with a Chinese stranglehold on Tibet, there would have been many Tibetans who wouldn't have recognized the Dalai Lama as anything but one of many significant senior lamas. But now it's quite different, of course. Now Tibetans, faced with this situation, Tibetans virtually all recognize the Dalai Lama as their leader.
It was interesting in your book that even in areas that seem to you to be 100% Tibetan, with no Chinese people there at all, Han Chinese people, it's not free and it's not peaceful. And if you scratch the surface, there was a great deal of resentment and unrest.
Well, you're probably referring to a part of the book where I go to the grasslands, and the grasslands make up a pretty significant part of the Tibetan Plateau. First off, let me just say they're just stunning. They're beautiful, even though it's very high, probably somewhere between 9 and 12,000 feet. Because it's a little closer to the equator, you actually do have significant grass growing at that altitude. And that's where the Tibetan nomads would generally graze their yaks. And you go to these things, and they're just, you see off in the horizon wildflowers in these grasslands. It's just beautiful. So I go with a young Tibetan to a village that's really pretty, what's actually rather close to where the current Dalai Lama was born. I don't want to go into specifics because I could harm him if I gave any more indications who he was, but so I go to this grasslands, and I remark to him several times over the course of a couple of days that it seems entirely Tibetan. But he says, no, there's just still a lot of political control here. And at one point he says, come with me. And we walk up to a hillock behind a small monastery. And he brings out a monk there, and we sit down in this gusty kind of cold wind on this hillock over these grasslands. And the monk begins to tell me a story, and basically, he was a very well-educated guy, and we had to speak in Chinese because I don't speak Tibetan, but his Chinese was good, and mine was good enough to have a conversation about all this. So he said that basically he'd spent 6 years in Lhasa at one of the biggest monasteries in the Tibetan capital and had become very aware. I mean, it really sort of progressed as a monk, as a Buddhist adept, and but he'd also grown very disenchanted with Chinese rule. And he had was after the terrible unrest in Lhasa. There were riots there in March of 2008, and he was at one of the monasteries that rose up, where many of the monks rose up. He was thrown in jail. And months later, in this jail, the Chinese interrogators came up to him and said, we know you're an instigator. And he said, no, I wasn't an instigator. And they went back and forth, and he was adamant in his denials. And they said, well, look at this videotape. And they had videotaped him where it was apparent that he was an instigator. And he, you know, what could he say at that point? But it was, you know, that's part of the situation of the religious institutions of Tibet today. They are almost, you know, everyone I went in, and by all accounts, they are completely filmed. There's closed-circuit cameras throughout the monasteries to monitor the Tibetan monks. And who's watching those tapes? No one really knows, but they know they go to some area near the monastery, and state security apparatus is always looking. So this monk ended up, you know, I think about 8 months in jail, finally released back to his home village where we were talking, and he was told in no uncertain terms that he was not allowed to leave that village again. He could not go back to Lhasa, so he was under lockdown in this village. And, you know, this kind of story is repeated time and again all across the Tibetan Plateau.
We're talking to Tim Johnson. His book is called Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. Now, as you've described, the Dalai Lama has established not only a kind of government in exile, but also a worldwide following of both spiritual and political followers and fans. Why has all of this not really gained any traction for him in negotiating with the Chinese?
Well, that too is a good question. Let me start with his worldwide fame on a very mundane level. I was doing a crossword puzzle this weekend from the Los Angeles Times, and the Dalai Lama's name comes up as an answer to a question. I mean, that's how much he's ingrained himself into our culture. He's, you know, he's a question on Jeopardy. He's you know, he's been in movies. I saw The Social Network. His name came up there. They've mentioned him on the Seinfeld. I'm sorry, on The Simpsons, on Frasier. You know, he was a line in that movie Caddyshack back in 1980. He's just a part of modern culture in a very pop culture-ish sort of way. But he's also a deeply respected. I've heard him described as a universal moral figure because he transcends Tibetan Buddhism. His message of interfaith harmony and you know, compassion and warm-heartedness of the need for that among human beings is one that goes much beyond Tibetan Buddhism. It's something that a lot of people all around the world are very eager to hear, and they flock to see him. So, you know, he can easily fill a stadium of 20, 30, 40,000 people. And so, you know, this gives him tremendous what's political scientists might call soft power. He's a guy people, world leaders want to see, but the costs are tremendous. So if you look at the list of people he's seen in the last 5 years, there's hundreds of religious leaders, political leaders, presidents, prime ministers, kings, princes, of all kinds of people that he goes to see. Yet every time he does venture abroad, which is about once a month, the Chinese try to thwart him. So there he is rubbing elbows with, you know, President Obama in the United States or all kinds of European leaders. But what happens is that the economic clout of China and the world's engagement with China economically has grown by such a magnitude that while you have one policy on Capitol Hill where legislators like former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi or the senators from California Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, you know, they're singing his praises forever. And in fact, Republicans often very conservative Republicans will too, because they really embrace this idea that there needs to be religious freedom in China. People on Capitol Hill embrace the Dalai Lama, but President Obama or President Bush before him will sit in the White House, and they will have to engage with business leaders who are doing tremendous trade with China. If the CEO of Walmart walks in the White House, he can say that the trade that Walmart does, what it imports from China, would make it the, if it were a country, would make it the eighth largest country in the world. So this is tremendous economic pressure. You've got, major U.S. corporations, Motorola, even the internet companies, Yahoo and Google, they're doing a lot of business. They have done a lot of business in China.
We're talking to Tim Johnson, author of the book Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World But Lost the Battle with China. You lived for years in Beijing. What do Chinese people learn about Tibet from the Chinese media? You described an exhibition in China. What do Chinese people know about Tibet?
They will have as fuzzy an idea as most Americans would have of it, but in a very different angle of the prism. Chinese would be adamant from what they've heard through the media, the Chinese media, that Tibet is an integral part of China, that any discussion otherwise is a plot by foreign powers designed to try to rein China in, to keep it from rising, to thwart it. So the Chinese would just almost to a T, including very well-educated Chinese, would have that position. They would have been taught, that Tibet was integral to China because of the 700 years of maybe perhaps not sovereignty over Tibet, but certainly, a big brother looking over Tibet with rights to intercede. So the Chinese would have that view, and they would generally, if I were generalized, they would believe the government line that the Dalai Lama himself and the whole lineage of Dalai Lamas were basically like feudal lords and would rule over monasteries that would keep Tibetans in serfdom and, have dungeons in the basements of the monasteries. Now, there's a seed of truth in all of this. Tibet, prior to the Chinese Revolution, had elements of it that were feudalistic. The people would be, Tibetans would be, could be seen as indentured to monasteries, although, exiled Tibetans tell me that it wasn't really a situation that Tibetans really opposed deeply. It was just a social structure as it existed prior. Anyways, the Chinese would see China as a huge modernizing force in Tibet and would look with consternation and actual anger at why Tibetans are so ungrateful for what they're doing. It's your average Chinese would just go, this is beyond my comprehension, and would probably have racism towards Tibetans because of that. I hesitate in some ways to use this analogy, but it's almost the level of feelings between the Tibetans and the Han Chinese at times reminds me of what I read it would have been like in the Deep South in the U.S. There was a sense probably that people with strong racist attitudes towards African Americans would have thought, we've done so much for them. Why aren't they grateful for us? And not totally uncomprehending of why that would have generated so much anger.
The narrative you're describing is kind of like a communist Marxist narrative of liberating the old-fashioned working classes or serf classes and creating a new kind of modern liberated world. But from the Tibetans' point of view, they have suffered really genuine and very forceful repression, which the Chinese don't know about, partly because of what you call in your book the Great Firewall. Tell us about that.
Well, there certainly is a lockdown in terms of information, so that if you're within China, you're pretty severely restricted in terms of what kind of information you can access over the internet. Now, for a great majority of Chinese, it doesn't matter. They can get the gossip, the movie gossip, all the songs. They can yeah, access pirated movies from the West, their own movies and so forth over the internet, and they don't have any interest in this. But for those who do want to find out more, you really have a great difficulty in doing so. Now, a very small minority, can access technology that allows them to breach this great firewall, this censorship set up by Beijing. But even if they do that, it doesn't mean that they would necessarily agree with the position that we might commonly have in the West about these issues. There's a very strong streak of nationalism in China, and so even those who do have access to lots of information are very, very proud about China's rise and determined that it's going to become, an equal, if not a superior, to the United States.
And I just have to say, as an aside, you cannot access this program, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe podcast site, in China. Now, as you describe in your book, China is basically waiting for the Dalai Lama to die. What do they think is going to happen after that?
Well, pardon me just for one thing. If I can say China, what I really mean is the ruling party of China, because
right.
That's who is calling the shots. Now, the ruling party has engaged the Dalai Lama's envoys from the Tibetan exile movement in a process of negotiations. There have been 9 rounds of negotiations since 2002, 9 or 10, depending on how you count the meetings. And they have really led nowhere. In fact, the Chinese propaganda machinery has really used this failure to attain any headway in these negotiations as a way to actually probably increase Han Chinese anger at the Tibetans. Because the negotiations have basically been, the Chinese have only been willing to say, well, the Dalai Lama can come back and live in Beijing. He cannot go to Tibet, and we'll provide him with his food and his housing here in Beijing and keep him under lock and key, basically. And the Tibetans say, no, that's not what we're negotiating. We're negotiating for greater autonomy on a series of issues of, you know, education, religion, language, demographic composition, and all this sort of thing. These failed negotiations have unfolded, and I think the Chinese Communist Party has realized that they think that they just need for the Dalai Lama to die, and this problem, this threat of ethnic restiveness will go away. Now, the Dalai Lama is going to be 76 in July, so he may have a decade, 2 decades of life left. Who knows? He's quite fit. He had a gallbladder operation a couple of years ago, but he's basically quite fit. And the Chinese are willing to just sit this out. They feel that once the Dalai Lama dies, they will appropriate for themselves the process of finding a reincarnated lad, a reincarnation, to become the 15th Dalai Lama, and they will take this young Tibetan boy and inculcate in him a love of China, and so that he will parrot the line of the party, so they think that this will, combined with aggressive investment in Tibet to try to raise the standard of living, will dissipate ethnic restiveness.
What are the Dalai Lama's own ideas about his succession?
Well, he said many, many things, and it's an issue, of course, that just every journalist asks him, and the Dalai Lama meets with the press all the time. I've seen him in press conferences in 3 vastly different countries. Not only journalists, but also Tibetan exiles themselves ask him, what is going to happen? First of all, the Tibetans, they venerate him. They see him as a god king. So they cannot imagine life without the Dalai Lama, without this Dalai Lama, and they just can only hope that there is a reincarnated Dalai Lama that continues with the whole tradition. The Dalai Lama himself says that it's up to Tibetans to decide if he's been useful, if the institution of the Dalai Lama has been something that they value and care about. And I think he says that genuinely. And I, of course, he also knows the answer, that he's been indispensable for them. And then he goes on to say, look, do you, you know, if Tibetans feel that it should go on, then there can be a reincarnation, but it will be have to be a reincarnation born outside of China. It has to be a child born in freedom. And this has angered China no end. And then he's also said, look, you know, it could be a girl this time. Of course, all Dalai Lamas have been male, but he says, no, the women have, you know, this could be very different. He's also thrown up the possibility that there could be a reincarnation selected in his, you know, as he's grown much older. That, in other words, a reincarnation could take place before his death. And there's actually a real esoteric tradition where this does occur. It's called Made Tulku, and it's excited Tibetans no end because in some ways it would shorten that period in which there's no mature Dalai Lama. And, you know, there's usually, just like in a Western monarchy or something, you know, a king dies and the heir is very young. There's a period in which there are regents who sort of control the court. Well, the same thing happens in Tibetan Buddhism. There are regents and senior tutors who really are involved in engaged in the training of the Dalai Lama in religious matters, but also in, you know, calling a lot of the shots in terms of how to govern. So the Dalai Lama says that's a possibility too, and he also says, hey, you know, maybe there could be an election. He could be like the College of Cardinals in the Roman Catholic Church or something like that. So he's thrown the door open to all these possibilities, and he hasn't tipped his hand in terms of what he himself believes should happen.
Now, the Dalai Lama is betting that he will outlive the one-party authoritarian communist government of China, and that system will give way to one that's more open to Tibetan autonomy. Are there any signs, in your view, that he might be right?
Well, we just have to read the newspapers. You just have to look at how many one-party or dictatorial regimes in the Middle East have teetered and even toppled. You know, we've seen Egypt and Tunisia, and now the news is all about Libya and so forth. So these kinds of events make the Chinese Communist Party quite concerned because it again reveals that one-party authoritarian states, by their nature, can face these uprisings and these crises and can lose power suddenly. I mean, we've seen it over and over again in the past few decades with the fall of communism and so forth. So the Dalai Lama said to me personally that he thought that he would outlive the Communist Party in its present form. And he didn't go into great detail about this, but I took it as meaning that, you know, maybe in the future he sees perhaps something evolve in China as evolved in Japan post-war, in which the Liberal Democratic Party, which was, you know, virtually a one-party state in Japan as well, began to have factions within the party that would become rivals of each other, and you would still have a one-party system, but a lot more contention for ideas and ruling practices and so forth. So, you know, I think the Dalai Lama does see the Chinese Communist Party is imperiled with the passage of time. And he told me he thinks he'll outlive it in his current state. He doesn't think it'll last. Now, so you have the two sides, both just kind of thinking that they will out-survive the other. And which side is right? Well, that's it's really difficult to tell.
If the major issues that China is concerned with in Tibet are strategic and resource issues, as you mentioned earlier, the landmass, the location, the water, the rivers, and so on, from China's point of view, and then from Tibet's point of view, what they want is more religious and cultural freedom, why can't they come to terms? In other words, what would be lost for the Chinese in granting more religious and cultural freedom to Tibet as long as they kept a hold of their resources?
Well, that's something that the Tibetans debate all the time. And the short answer, in my view, is that Because of history, the Communist Party is extremely concerned about any sense that it would not be unifying, you know, what is modern-day China. And it's not just the Tibetans. You have to look at a map of China and see the far west and northwest is the what the Chinese call the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and that is comprises a large population of Muslim Uyghurs, and these are a Turkic-speaking group of people who are really Central Asians. They speak a language that's similar to modern-day Turkish, and they're extremely disgruntled, as we saw in really rampaging protests in the summer of 2009 in the capital city, Urumqi, where more than 200 people died. So if you're a Communist Party leader in the party headquarters in Beijing, and you look out at the periphery of the country, you see the Tibetans in the southwest as being potentially very restive. The Muslim Uyghurs in the west also showing that they're deeply unhappy with China. At least many of them are deeply unhappy with Chinese rule. You've got ethnic Koreans on the border with North Korea. You have 2 to 3 million ethnic Koreans living there, with a situation on the Korean Peninsula that is not stable in the long term by any sense. And you begin to sense, you know, and of course the Chinese are trying to regain control of Taiwan. They feel if there's any chink in that armor of this, you know, ongoing battle to make the Chinese nation cohesive, then the whole thing's going to fall apart. It could, you know, as Mao said, you know, it takes just one spark to start the wildfire. So they're just absolutely determined not to give an inch on these issues. So that's probably the best explanation that I've heard about why they don't reach an accommodation. And, you know, there are plenty of people who say, well, this is very short-sighted because actually you could negotiate with some of these minority groups in a way which would alleviate a lot of this you know, simmering discontent. It's hard to say. It's hard to say if that's true or not.
Given that we are so economically tied into China, not only as a trading partner, but we owe them a huge amount of money, is there any role for American public opinion, and indeed for world public opinion at this point, in changing the relationship between China and Tibet?
Oh, that's difficult to know for sure. But I personally believe that in our, by our, I'm meaning as a, American citizens, is we are so eager to buy the inexpensive products manufactured in China. We really lose sight of the fact that we're empowering them more and more to behave as they are behaving, as they're becoming a rising superpower. And I think that, you know, I think it takes a lot more awareness of some of these factors would be healthy for us as Americans, because I think that, you know, while there are many, many ethnic groups around the country, around the world, facing these sorts of pressures, the Tibetan case is special because, in some ways, it's a way to measure how China is behaving as a rising power, essentially a superpower. You know, and I think that what we're seeing is that in Tibet, the policy is give no quarter in the process of trying to assimilate these people into the Chinese nation. And, you know, it doesn't take a great leap to think that as China gets more powerful, it will turn that kind of outlook onto other groups and even, you know, other nations, you know, the Japanese or the Vietnamese, or in a sense, it may be their position on a number of issues with the U.S.
Let's say some amazing democracy movement were to happen and Tibet were to somehow gain the autonomy that it was looking for. There are a lot of problems that would have to be solved in Lhasa and in the whole of the Tibetan region, including dealing with the very large number of Chinese, as you mentioned, who have moved there. How are Tibetans thinking about how, if they had the chance to solve those problems, they would do so?
it's a big question mark about, you know, what would happen if there were just a snap of the finger somewhere and the Tibetans were told, okay, you run things, could they do it? Would Lhasa be overrun with Burger Kings? Would Western culture and an endless parade of backpackers, you know, smoking hashish, destroy what the West thought it would, you know, save by doing this? Well, these are good questions, and it's hard to know. I actually asked the Dalai Lama that, and he said he thinks that Tibetans are wise enough to deal with the forces of Western culture that could be seen to be sort of debasing Tibetan culture, and others in the Tibetan exile government insist that the Tibetan diaspora has the know-how, and that there would be so much goodwill in the rest of the world in terms of assistance and so forth, that they could run the place either under a system of greater autonomy or even of independence. And, you know, whether that's true, I don't know. I mean, you walk around the Tibetan government in exile, and it's like a sleepy, a sleepy town somewhere. It's not a, it doesn't have the horror and rigor of a national government, say. So it's a big question, you know, even if the Tibetans could they actually govern for themselves? I'm sure they could, but whether they'd be successful or not, I don't think is really known.
The subtitle of your book is How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World But Lost the Battle with China. In your view, is there anything that he could have done differently?
Well, there are things he could have done differently. There are many... there's a group of Tibetan exiles who criticize him in a very... I use the word criticize maybe a little loosely because Tibetans, of course, venerate him. But there are some who suggest that His Holiness the Dalai Lama could have taken a different approach. And they say, why didn't the Tibetans, for instance, try to, you know, rally their wagons with underground Christians and human rights groups and perhaps the Falun Gong movement that appeared in China in the late 90s and, you know, all kinds of other forces in some sort of unified effort to challenge the Communist Party, including all sorts of pro-democracy groups. Well, that's the suggestion that maybe that was a mistake. Others say maybe it was a mistake for him not to accede to Chinese conditions for a visit back to Tibet back in the early 90s, late 1980s, early 90s. But the reality is that it's really hard to judge whether that would have changed things. In fact, if there had been a unified opposition to the party, it could have been crushed. And it could have been crushed in a form that would have left the Tibetan movement far weaker than it is today. So passing judgment on whether the Dalai Lama made mistakes or not is a difficult thing. And he himself says, you know, when asked about these things, he says, past is past. What's important is the future. And I think that by that he means... You know, there's not a lot of value to be gained by trying to second-guess some of these decisions. They've just happened. Now the challenge is how to maintain the Tibetan culture and to determine if they can find a way to have greater say in their own destiny.
Tim Johnson is an award-winning journalist. His new book is Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World But Lost the Battle with China. He is currently the bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers in Mexico City. Perhaps one day we'll get to talk about Mexico at some point, I hope.
Gladly, Mary Charlotte. I'd be happy to.
Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And once again, Tim Johnson will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe on Friday, February 25th at 6 in the evening. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.